this newborn child. Feelings of enmity towards brothers and sisters must occur far more frequently during the age of childhood than is noted by the dull observation of adults. In the case of my own children, who followed one another rapidly, I missed the opportunity to make such observations. I am now retrieving it through my little nephew, whose complete domination was disturbed after 15 months by the arrival of a female competitor. I hear it is true that the young man acts very chivalrously towards his little sister, that he kisses her hand and pets her. But in spite of this, I have convinced myself that even before the completion of his second year, he is using his new facility in language to criticize this person who seems superfluous to him. Whenever the conversation turns upon her, he chimes in and cries angrily, "Too little, too little!" During the last few months, since the child has outgrown this unfavorable criticism, owing to its splendid development, he has found another way of justifying his insistence that she does not deserve so much attention. On all suitable occasions he reminds us, "She hasn't any teeth." We have all preserved the recollection of the eldest daughter of another sister of mine, how the child, which was at that time 6 years old, sought assurance from one aunt after another for 1.5 hours with the question, "Lucy can't understand that yet, can she?" Lucy was the competitor, 2.5 years younger. I have never failed in any of my female patients to find this dream of the death of brothers and sisters denoting exaggerated hostility. I have met with only one exception, which could easily be reinterpreted into a confirmation of the rule. Once, in the course of a sitting, while I was explaining this condition of affairs to a lady, as it seemed to have a bearing upon the symptoms under consideration, she answered, to my astonishment, that she had never had such dreams. However, she thought of another dream which supposedly had nothing to do with the matter, a dream which she had first dreamed at the age of 4, when she was the youngest child, and had since dreamed repeatedly. A great number of children, all of them the dreamer's brothers and sisters, and male and female cousins, were romping about in a meadow. Suddenly they all got wings, flew up, and were gone. She had no idea of the significance of the dream, but it will not be difficult for us to recognize it as a dream of the death of all the brothers and sisters, in its original form, and little influenced by the censor. I venture to insert the following interpretation. At the death of one out of a large number of children, in this case the children of 2 brothers were brought up in common as brothers and sisters, is it not probable that our dreamer, at that time not yet 4 years old, asked a wise, grown-up person, "What becomes of children when they are dead?" The answer probably was, "They get wings and become angels." According to this explanation, all the brothers and sisters and cousins in the dream now have wings like angels, and, this is the important thing, they fly away. Our little angel-maker remains alone, think of it, the only one after such a multitude. The feature that the children are romping about on a meadow points with little ambiguity to butterflies, as though the child had been led by the same association which induced the ancients to conceive Psyche as having the wings of a butterfly. Perhaps someone will now object that, although the inimical impulses of children towards their brothers and sisters may well enough be admitted, how does the childish disposition arrive at such a height of wickedness as to wish death to a competitor or stronger playmate, as though all transgressions could be atoned for only by the death punishment? Whoever talks in this manner forgets that the childish idea of being dead has little else but the words in common with our own. The child knows nothing of the horrors of decay, of shivering in the cold grave, of the terror of the infinite nothing, which the grown-up person, as all the myths concerning the great beyond testify, finds it so hard to bear in his conception. Fear of death is strange to the child, therefore it plays with the horrible word, and threatens another child. "If you do that again, you will die, as Francis died." Whereat the poor mother shudders, for perhaps she cannot forget that the great majority of mortals do not succeed in living beyond the years of childhood. It is still possible, even for a child 8 years old, on returning from a museum of natural history, to say to its mother, "Mama, I love you so. If you ever die, I'm going to have you stuffed and set you up here in the room so I can always, always see you." So little does the childish conception of being dead resemble our own. Being dead means for the child, which has been spared the scenes of suffering previous to dying, the same as being gone, not disturbing the survivors any more. The child does not distinguish the manner and means by which this absence is brought about, whether by travelling, estrangement, or death. If, during the prehistoric years of a child, a nurse has been sent away, and its mother has died a short while after, The two experiences, as is revealed by analysis, overlap in his memory. The fact that the child does not miss very intensely those who are absent has been realized by many a mother to her sorrow after she has returned home after a summer journey of several weeks and has been told upon inquiry, "The children have not asked for their mother a single time." But if she really goes to that undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveller returns, the children seem at first to have forgotten her, and begin only subsequently to remember the dead mother. If, then, the child has motives for wishing the absence of another child, every restraint is lacking which would prevent it from clothing this wish in the form that the child may die, and the psychic reaction to the dream of wishing death proves that, in spite of all the differences in content, the wish in the case of the child is somehow or other the same as it is with adults. If now the death wish of the child towards its brothers and sisters has been explained by the childish egotism which causes the child to regard its brothers and sisters as competitors, how may we account for the same wish towards parents, who bestow love on the child and satisfy its wants, and whose preservation it ought to desire from these very egotistical motives? In the solution of this difficulty, we are aided by the experience that dreams of the death of parents predominantly refer to that member of the parental couple which shares the sex of the dreamer, so that the man mostly dreams of the death of his father, the woman of the death of her mother. I cannot claim that this happens regularly, but the predominating occurrence of this dream in the manner indicated is so evident that it must be explained through some factor that is universally operative. To express the matter boldly, it is as though a sexual preference becomes active at an early period, as though the boy regards his father as a rival in love, and as though the girl takes the same attitude toward her mother, a rival by getting rid of whom he or she cannot but profit. Before rejecting this idea as monstrous, let the reader consider the actual relations between parents and children. What the requirements of culture and piety demand of this relation must be distinguished from what daily observation